that, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's Monday, January 6th. I feel like it feels like 2020 has been around forever. It's only 6 days into 2020. And I think it's because we've been talking about in anticipation of 2020, in anticipation of the primary, in anticipation of the impeachment. It just feels like it's such an old year, and it's only just begun. It's only just begun. All right, everyone. So we're not at war yet, but that's – the operative word is yet. But Donald Trump, the most unreliable, lying, you know what. I mean, how do you believe anything coming out of his mouth? This is such a problem that, you know, when you lie and you lie and you lie, and then he makes some suggestion about what the Iranians are about to do, and I'm thinking – is this real or is this Memorex? Anyway, all right, monsieur, what would you like to talk about?
I don't know about Memorex, but is this real or is this total madness?
It is absolutely madness.
Unbelievable. Yeah. People talked about it as being insane and emotionally unstable and everything, but all I could think about with what he's up to now is that he's really like a madman, like Nero fiddling while Rome burns. That's what it feels like Trump is doing. Let's try a little of this. Let's try a little war. Let's try a little...
Any distraction will do him. Any distraction. Any distraction. I mean, and think about this. So we were talking about impeachment, impeachment, impeachment. Now we're talking about Iran, 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 all right? Mm-hmm. And then we were... It's amazing. I feel like we're playing a game of, like, volleyball, and I'm being hit back and forth and being spiked down. I don't know what to focus on. Because I'm trying to figure out how do we change the dynamic that he has set in place.
Yeah. But, you know, people talk about the movie Wag the Dog.
Yeah.
And this almost seems worse than that. Wag the Dog had rational people thinking about evil and phony, but rational things to do, start a war where you know what is going to come of it, a lot of blood. But this guy Trump's just sort of like literally, you know, what a bull in a china shop is like, oh, look over here, and, you know, smashes a whole bunch of valuable stuff. And look over there and, you know, kills bunches of people. And look over here and put off doing anything about climate change. We'll set whatever we did do in the last decade. Let's set it back a few years. And
I don't know.
I don't know. Did you read the book The Hunger Games?
No.
Well, you know what it's about, right? Mm-hmm. It's about young people competing to the death.
Right.
And the people that operate the game are sitting in a bubble in the capital city where they control the world. And they make a TV series out of this or internet, whatever it was, you know, out of the young people killing each other. And these masters of the game say, oh, let's try floods, and boom, they, you know, snap their fingers and floods come down on all these young people and see how they react. And, let's try a little, you know, man-eating monkeys, and let's try fire. And that's what Trump is like, it seems to me. He's just sort of he lunges around the room, or around the globe in this case, and perpetrates these atrocities where other people are, you know, fighting and getting killed to the death. It's
terrifying.
Oh, yeah. Let's see what happens if I kill Iran's military leader.
Well, I posted something on my Twitter feed, and I don't know if I can find it. I'm so bad at this. But I wrote – here's what I wrote. I wrote, Donald Trump is alone on the world stage. He is alone in the White House. He is alone in his lying mind. And now we are alone in that dark place with him.
Mm.
And that's how I feel. I feel like he sucked us in to this very dark and frightening place where nothing is real, nothing is true. There is no moral values. There is no – I mean, people keep talking about the Trump policy. There is no policy. How could they even use the word policy in association with Trump?
Right.
I mean, to even suggest it to me seems to be so foolish.
Policy, first of all, is something that one thinks through.
Exactly.
Or, maybe bases on fact.
Exactly. And does in consultation with people. But remember, he's smarter than the generals.
And follows through on, doesn't change it every week. I don't,
I don't know.
He's more like the Hunger Games masters than anything else. He's just doing these things for a lark. Let's see what happens. And that's why I thought of the madman.
Yeah.
I mean, he is just.
But here's the scary part, Ken. How can half or 40% or all the Republicans either not see it, not appreciate it, have lost their sense of this is not partisan. He's not a Republican. He's an evil, lying human being. He is not a party.
Well, he's a dictator.
He's a despot.
And they are doing it not because they believe it. I mean, some of them may believe it, but I think they're doing it because they know he'll assassinate them next. Maybe not literally, but politically.
Yeah. But it didn't work in Kentucky. Let me just remind you, it didn't work in Kentucky. He went into Kentucky to basically support the Republican candidate for governor, who was the incumbent. And guess what? Every other Republican won but him. But him. So it's really interesting. And he so embraced him and made him his boy. And his boy lost. So
yeah. Well, of course,
remember.
His boy, Mitch McConnell, was.
Well, he's up in 2020. I'm just telling you.
But I mean, he's not exactly trying to check Trump's.
Not at all. But because he's able to manipulate Trump for his benefit as well. Look, his wife is in the administration. We keep forgetting that. Isn't that amazing? How do we forget that? It's just shocking. All right, we got to get going. This is our Rethink the Week, everyone, and it's going to be fun. We haven't had Jeff Feingold, the editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, joining us in a long time, and I'm really glad that he said yes. And then we'll be grabbing Stephen Pimpower, who's at his office at the University of New Hampshire in Manchester. And shortly, I'm sure, Dean Spiliotis will be joining us, who is at Southern New Hampshire University. But I saw this tweet, and many of you have been following, I'm sure, Anand, how do I pronounce his last name? Gitarades. You know, he's just very articulate and very handsome, by the way, as well. And he speaks a lot about things like, you know, the wealth gap. He speaks a lot about charity and how charity, you know, sounds good on paper, but in the end, it's a way of manipulation. I actually kind of agree with him on that. But he put a tweet out the other day, and I thought it was fascinating. He wrote, "I spent 2019 hearing people ask how we'd pay for Medicare for all. Thus far in 2020, we're only 6 days in, everyone, I have not heard any of the same people ask, how would we pay for a war in Iran? Isn't that so the case? You know, we never calculate the cost of death. We only spend time calculating the cost of health and claiming we can't afford it. Isn't that remarkable?" Anyway, I thought that was absolutely fascinating tweet. And our topics for today are, and I thought this was another good one, and I put this as my first topic for our Rethink the Week, in part because I think it underlies every single aspect of what's going to be happening in 2020. And the article was from The Guardian, and it was a question that said, "Media leaders agonize over amplifying Trump lies as 2020 election year begins." And I think it's a really, really fascinating question, because I think it really sort of speaks to how we cover absolutely everything, including as what I just said to Ken, which is, you know, he's talking about this imminent threat from Iran. And this is a man who's lied about everything, from the most simplistic, obvious things like crowd size to, you know, how many thousands and thousands of lies that do you believe him? Do you believe him? And even if it's true, I don't have the capacity to trust him. You know, and of course, he will not present this with any kind of information. So I just thought that was a really interesting article at The Guardian. And I thought it was really important for us to sort of talk about, how do you cover someone who has spent so much time lying to the American people? Joining us right now by phone are our two guests, and we're still waiting for Dean Spiliotis. Stephen Pimpare is a scholar and a fellow at the Carsey Institute. He also is a teacher and professor at UNH Manchester. His area of expertise is in issue of poverty and homelessness. Welcome back to the program, Stephen.
Hi, Arnie.
And we also haven't talked to Jeff Feingold, the award-winning editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, for a long time. And every time I say the Business Review, they go, Arnie, Jeff Feingold, Business Review? Tell me about this. So, Jeff, how long have you been covering New Hampshire from a media perspective? I want people to understand the decades that are under your belt.
Yeah. Well, probably since the day I got here, but...
Yeah. How many years?
I've been in New Hampshire now as a professional journalist since 1981.
Isn't that amazing?
I'm afraid to do the math, but yeah. I think I'm in my 39th year.
Unbelievable, unbelievable.
The golden also, years of Ronald Reagan.
Exactly. And also joining us right now is Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar and presidential scholar from Southern New Hampshire University, and he is the editor of nhpoliticalcapital.com, as well as a commentator on NHPR. I don't know where to begin. Since Jeff, we haven't talked to you in like a dog's age. Let's start with you. Obviously, what's happening in Iran is now consuming us 24/7. It is also changing the conversation with the presidential candidates running in 2020. Because up until this point in time, foreign policy was something that you might have mumbled about, but you really weren't sort of put on the front line to address. But now you have no place to hide. You have to talk about it. And the problem is you have to talk about it in such a level of extremeness because of what happened. So I guess I'm going to sort of talk to you. How does the Iran situation either benefit or harm any of the candidates running for office?
You're talking about the Democratic candidates?
Yeah, the Democratic candidates, so, obviously.
At this point, we really don't know very much about it, but I think just the instinctive thing is that there'll be more of a focus on foreign policy, on international affairs, and if that becomes the case, then there'll be, you know, probably maybe people will be rethinking, you know, let someone obviously like Joe Biden, who has, you know, strong credentials in that sense, whether mm-hmm. they're good credentials or not is another matter.
Yes.
But he does have those credentials, and it's possible that people who maybe weren't thinking about him anymore might say, you know, maybe he's not so bad after all. I do have to say another thing is that, you know, I think the biggest fear about the Trump administration was that the man in charge is, you know, basically an incompetent who has no real understanding, intellectual grasp of what it means to be president.
Right.
And when it comes to something like this, it's obvious. It's just the deficiencies are glaring. And I think at this point, after all the twists and turns and the turnover in the White House, is that I think that it's pretty obvious that the incompetence extends just to also to his top officials. I mean, to think that there was no one at the National Security Council who would say to him, you know, this is not a good idea. This has been an idea that's been rejected X number of times, and it's a reason why this idea was rejected, to assassinate Soleimani.
Right.
And no one was there to do it. I mean, he picks the people, but it's obvious that this is what we have reaped right now by having a grossly incompetent person as the president.
Well, but Steve, what I see is what Donald Trump values is someone who basically not only does not push back, but basically says, yes, Mesa. I mean, I think this is really what this is. Kiss my ring, kiss my you-know-what. He doesn't want pushback. He doesn't want information. He doesn't want to play it out. In fact, I think sometimes they feed him choices that they know he will both comprehend. I mean, he understands assassinations. I mean, I hate to say that's about as sophisticated as he gets in international policy. And even though it might have been the last on the list, which is what we keep hearing from places like the New York Times and the Washington Post, and that a lot of the folks in the Defense Department were kind of shocked that he chose that, they should have known, given his previous responses, that this is something he could glom onto because it isn't sophisticated. You know, it's kind of a black and white switch. So I feel to a large extent that his lack of depth is something that everyone around him understands. The problem is that what do we do about it, Stephen?
Well, I mean, I think Jeff's point about sort of the questions about the extent to which sort of ordinary decision making processes may or may not be functioning is a good one. But I think the problem is deeper than this, right? The reporting that at least I've seen coming out this morning suggests that SB Pompeo and Pence, two of the three of them, travel down to Florida in order to make this pitch, right? This was not, at least from that reporting, Trump on his own looking in order to make an aggressive public statement, not understanding the potential ramifications, although surely that's a piece of what's going on here. But because of not even dysfunction, right? I mean, think about what we know about the decision to go to war in Iraq under the George W. Bush administration.
Right?
That was anyone with any knowledge of that country and that region said, this is utterly insane, and the rationales that you are offering for it are completely fabricated. So, again, we're sort of back to the question, sort of rhetorically and dramatically, Trump is different. But how different is the Trump administration from the Bush administration when all is said and done?
Omar, so I asked that question initially, Dean, and that
Can I just say something about that, Jeffrey?
Because
I know exactly what you're talking about, but I think the big difference is it's one thing, and that is that even the Bush administration rejected this idea of assassinating Soleimani. Even they did.
Because it was a risk that even they didn't want to take.
Which is saying something. That I think is the big difference.
All right. So wait a minute. So I got a couple of things here, and I want to go back to the 2020 presidential candidates and how they're going to have to filter this through their campaigns as they, you know, gallop to the caucuses in Iowa. But I do have to think that the other problem, and I mentioned this at the very beginning of the show, Dean, is that Donald Trump has done everything alone. I mean, there was no conversation with our European allies, which will clearly be impacted by this. You know, and we don't know so much. I mean, we do know that he had a conversation, for example, with Putin a week ago. Did he tell Putin? You know, I mean, he might not have told Pelosi. He knows the letter P, but the only P he likes is the Putin P, not the Pelosi one. So, I mean, we know so little about him. We trust so little about him that the idea that he would consult Putin before he would consult the European allies or Pelosi is not only reasonable, it's incredibly predictable.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting listening to this discussion. There are two narratives on this right now, and I think maybe additional reporting will sort it out a little bit more. One is the narrative that you mentioned, Arnie, that they put this extreme option in the mix and no one thought he would choose it. The other option is that the other argument that you're seeing reported is that there were some people in the administration who have wanted to punish Iran for a long time,
right. And
they knew that they could sell something like this to Trump pretty easily, that he would kind of go for the idea of this kind of operation. In terms, there are these, both of those are out there right now, and I think, you know, journalists are trying to sort through which is more likely. But in any event, there's also a question about the extent to which they thought through, given that both Obama and Bush administrations declined to do this, mm-hmm. even though it's been on the radar for a good 10 years plus, did they think through the consequences of what the likely reaction would be. To talk about the campaign, I think Jeff hit the nail on the head. The primary discussion is going to be about Joe Biden's experience on the one hand, and then the Bernie Sanders and others, but especially Bernie Sanders, dissecting of the Biden decisions on foreign policy as kind of a pushback. And then in the wild cards are, you know, Pete Buttigieg is increasingly talking about his experience.
Yes, I know.
And Tulsi Gabbard is using her experience kind of with her. She's got her whole thing going on that some people think is going to turn into a third party challenge at some point. This kind of gives her additional impetus. So I think that's basically this is going to be a Biden versus the others in terms of kind of dissecting his decision making and whether or not it was good or bad.
So are you suggesting that it will push Warren further away from the top?
I just think that's where a lot of the attention is going to be. I mean, Warren is already slipping. The most recent polling has her fourth in Iowa, pretty far back from the other three. But I do think this is going to be Bernie is going to say he's been very consistent. He's the one who always opposed this kind of aggression. Let's look at what Joe Biden did and assess whether or not that's the kind of decision making you want. That's going to be the debate.
Let me just say something. So, Stephen, I actually think that Bernie is in the driver's seat here. And the reason why Bernie's in the driver's seat is everybody knows that we made a big mistake with Iraq. I think we all are on the same page, even though that, you know, Joe Biden was supportive of going to war in Iraq.
Yes.
But then you have the Afghanistan papers that came out. Oh, my freaking God. So the longest war has totally been screwed up. People have been lying for generations.
I voted for the 800 million before I voted against.
Yes, exactly.
We're going to be back doing that again, the Iraq war resolution.
So, Stephen, this is going to be so fascinating because in a lot of ways, you know, Joe's history has been to embrace all these things. Part of the reason we're in the impeachment was that he was tasked with Ukraine. How'd that work out? And now we've got the situation with Iran. And it's going to – I feel like this – I remember when Howard Dean first started running for president back in the aughts, whenever he ran, and it was all about the war in Iraq. And I keep feeling like, you know, I thought that was going to be yesterday's story. We're going to have that kind of sort of fierce debate being consolidated, Stephen, within a couple of weeks. I want to go back to Medicare for All.
So, I mean, I will confess that I'm a little uncomfortable sort of filtering this potentially cataclysmic provocation in the Mideast through the prison of the Democratic primary.
Yes.
That said, I'm going to go ahead and do it. I think there's another potential opening here, and that is maybe something that Warren could exploit, in that the sheer number of people with active and very recent interests in the defense industry and the oil and gas industry,
right,
who are likely to profit from any sort of conflagration
right.
in the region,
exactly.
And whether that not only opens up a space for us to be talking more seriously about foreign policy and foreign intervention more generally, but also then talking about the extent to which lobbyists across powerful industries are engaged in making decisions that will affect their bottom line.
So, Jeffrey, there was an article that came out about how Iran will respond. And, of course, they can respond like tomorrow, next week, next month. But one of the things that was being suggested was that they might actually look at their cybersecurity ability to attack. And you just heard Stephen say that who might benefit from this is going to be the oil and gas industry, because they're going to see the price spike and this will benefit them. So if I were Iran and I realized who might benefit from what's happening, maybe I would look at my cybersecurity threats and I would focus on what? On oil and gas. This to me is like, you want to make money on this? Guess what? Talk to Sheldon Adelson about what we did to him. Trust me, we know how to do it to you.
They're really serious. I mean, there's obviously a lot of that discussion going on right now, and it's
fear.
You could see with the price of oil going up, and quite honestly, it's economically speaking, that could be a major problem that I assume Trump didn't consider, because that's the one thing he had going for him, was the strength of the economy, and
right.
a spike in oil prices, especially a prolonged one, is not anything that any president wants, especially in a re-election year. But the other thing you have to remember is to the point about Elizabeth Warren and the other candidates, I think that unfortunately we learned in 2004, and then not unfortunately, but in 2008 we also learned that the aftermath of that Iraq war, that horrible decision, was really very toxic for certain candidates, and Hillary Clinton is a top one,
and it hurt
John Kerry actually,
yes.
Because Kerry never came up with a reasonable explanation,
yep.
or a defense of his position on the Iraq war, and I think that's pretty fresh in a lot of people's minds.
Yep. No, it's
and actually in a New Hampshire primary, it's very fresh in people's minds, because we have a very high percentage of people who are residents or members of the military or are related to members of the military,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's something that will come into play, and it's possible that someone like Bernie or Elizabeth Warren or maybe Pete Buttigieg, I don't know where he stands on this actually at this point, will have a way to give a narrative that certainly Democratic voters will respond to, and probably independent voters, if they, there actually are.
Well, but, so let me Dean, I did C-SPAN last week, and mm-hmm. one of the things I referred to Pete Buttigieg as a young Joe Biden. This changes my definition of Pete Buttigieg, what just happened with Iran. Because this is going to be an opportunity for him to talk about his experience, but his experience is a military experience, mm-hmm. as opposed to Joe Biden's experience, which is a policy of being wrong. Okay, mm-hmm. okay, and to a large extent, it has given Mayor Pete an opportunity to have a conversation with a base that basically hasn't embraced him. He hasn't gotten a lot of young people. He hasn't gotten people of color.
Yeah.
And this gives him a way of having a conversation that he didn't have before this.
It's certainly a new avenue of approach.
Yes.
And if my recollection is correct, over the weekend I saw him interviewed, and he didn't take the bait on the Biden decision-making. He instead said, you know, I'll let Biden speak for himself, and then he went on to talk about his own experience.
Right.
So he can engage this and use it without necessarily getting into the Bernie-Biden-Warren kind of back and forth that is inevitable about, the Biden folks are going to say it's his experience in decision-making, and the Sanders and Warren folks are going to say that's the problem, and that's going to be the back and forth.
Well, and let's be honest, though, Stephen. I mean, there is something to be said for Biden, because Biden is known by many of the European players that Donald Trump has basically trashed. And if you want to reestablish relationships with Germany and France and even the UK to some extent, despite the fact that Trump did seem to have a relationship with them, I think Biden is in a position to say, I'm the one to reestablish those connections because they know me, they trust me, and frankly, let's be honest, Stephen, they made the same mistakes we made because we did it together.
I mean, I don't know. It's unclear to me that any candidate, any of those Democratic candidates, should they become president, is going to look anything other than a breath of fresh air coming in the wake of Trump. And I think that all of those nations who are eager to try to reestablish more traditional relations with the United States will wind up doing that regardless of who the candidate is. So he may try that. It seems to me a bit of a stretch.
A bit.
You know, actually, Arnie, you're raising an interesting point about our alliances with other nations, because if you remember, the first Iraq war was, you know, a big alliance that the first Bush administration was able to rally a bunch of countries around to support it, and they referred to this as an international adventure.
Exactly.
And then, actually, the second Iraq war, they did get some allies to help them, especially in Iraq, but particularly in Afghanistan.
Yeah.
This time around, because he has been so successful in alienating just about every important ally we have, and certainly the citizens, the people in Europe, are not exactly hungry to be at war with Iran. And they obviously have not, because they those countries that signed that the nuclear deal have been trying to stay in it.
Right, and Iran just walked away.
And this is a really important point to be made, because this is big. The United States will be going alone, except maybe Netanyahu will be helping them, which is going to be a really big help for them.
Yeah. Well, and it's not just
I got to go to a break. This is Rethink the Week. It's Monday. It's the Attitude. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1941. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt gave a speech that would become one of the defining moments of his presidency. The world was embroiled in the Second World War. Debates raged about whether the United States should enter the conflict. At this critical time, Roosevelt delivered his State of the Union address. It became known as the Four Freedoms Speech. In it, President Roosevelt proposed four fundamental freedoms that should be shared by everyone in the world. They included the freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom from want, and the freedom from fear. Freedom of speech and freedom of worship had long been enshrined in the United States Constitution. But by declaring that people deserved freedom from want and fear, Roosevelt was charting new ground. It was this belief that undergirded his New Deal policies aimed at helping those devastated by the Great Depression. In his speech, Roosevelt declared that there were basic expectations by the people of the United States. They included jobs for those who can work, security for those who need it, the ending of special privilege for the few, the preservation of civil liberties for all, the enjoyment of the fruits of scientific progress in a wider and constantly rising standard of living. He then called for an increase in pensions, unemployment insurance, and access to medical care and jobs. In 1943, after the United States had entered the war, the Saturday Evening Post published a series of paintings by Norman Rockwell portraying each of the four freedoms outlined in the speech. The paintings by the popular artist helped to spread the idea of the freedoms to the American public. It's worth asking how far we've come in realizing these four freedoms today. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Visitors to Washington's Olympic Mountain stand in awe of glaciers that have carved the landscape. But what tourists see today is different from 100 years ago. Back then, Blue Glacier descended from Mount Olympus like an icy hand reaching out over the rock. Now that hand has retreated up the mountain. Nearby, at what was once Lillian Glacier, only snow patches remain.
It kind of reminds me of a birthday cake. You have this gorgeous birthday cake, and then 2 days later, it's just crumbs.
That's Andrew Fountain of Portland State University. Using glacier maps and historical photos, he estimates that the glaciers of the Olympic Mountains have shrunk by about 75% since 1900. Early in the century, much of the melting could be attributed to natural causes. But Fountain says now carbon pollution is warming the climate, and that's accelerating the glacier's retreat.
From 1981 to 2015, they shrunk about 40%.
He says without climate action, their future looks grim. By the end of this century, he expects the glaciers of the Olympic Mountains will be gone.
Maybe a few ice patches left in little nooks and crannies, but as far as we can see, they'll vanish.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
War is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. 'Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will. Think of all the weapons we make around the world, investing brains and money in the best ways how to kill. If we could use that money for the betterment of man and care about each other, there'd be peace throughout the land. War is not the answer, never was, never will. We will never live in peace unless and until we learn to love each other, not bomb, maim, and kill. 'Cause war is not the answer, never was and never will.
All right, everyone, we are back. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson is our Rethink the Week. Ken Barnes picks our music. Who sings War is Not the Answer, Monsieur?
This is Pat Scanlon with Vets for Peace.
I love it. I love it. Joining us right now by phone is Stephen Pimper. He is a fellow at the Carsey Institute. He also teaches at UNH in Manchester. Joining him also is Jeff Feingold, the editor of the New Hampshire Business Review, who's been writing about New Hampshire and New Hampshire politics and policies since 1981. Oh, my God. And also joining us is Dean Spiliotis, who's a civic scholar and a presidential scholar at Southern New Hampshire University. You know, you wrote the idea about war is not the answer, what we could spend the money on. I'm going to go back to that tweet that I use as my tweet of the day. I spent 2019 hearing people ask how we'd pay for Medicare for all.
Yeah.
Thus far in 2020, I've not heard any of the same people ask how we'd pay for a war in Iran. Oh, my God, that's exactly the point. Speaking of spending money, however, gentlemen, I want to talk about a guy by the name of Michael Bloomberg. And Michael Bloomberg, and this, I just love the title from the Vice piece. Michael Bloomberg is spending insane money to own Trump online. And let me just, the part that I loved about this story is that if you Googled Trump, what would come up as soon as you Google Trump was some statement by Michael Bloomberg trashing Trump. I mean, the guy is able to do this, and he's got billions to basically, pardon the expression, piss away. So I got to ask, and I'll start with you, Dean Spiliotis, what's Michael Bloomberg going to do? Because in a lot of ways, this distraction, impeachment, this distraction, Iran, all these things that are happening, you know, as the fight between the different candidates, I think this puts Michael Bloomberg into the driver's seat. He gets to pick his issues. He can spend the money. He can drive Trump nuts. He doesn't have to worry about a stupid caucus because, you know, after all, it's a group grope, you know. And he's, I mean, when you think about all these things, in a way, he gets to sort of dictate the terms of his race.
And he can, basically do what he wants.
What he wants. And in this chaos, that may not be such a bad thing.
Yeah, if he's not concerned about being on the debate stage, then there's not a lot the DNC can really do to put him to the side. He seems to already have a strategy that he thinks may work. We'll see. I mean, we'll know a lot more after the March 3rd, Super Tuesday, and I think March 10th another multi-state day, whether or not this strategy is paying off. But it's true, you know, and there people have been saying all along that, you know, Bloomberg should be using his wealth to go after Trump and weaken Trump as a candidate, maybe not as a candidate himself,
right,
but in other venues. So right, in some sense, he does that. We all know that Bloomberg gets under his skin like few other people,
mm-hmm,
I think because he's so much richer than Trump, and that really aggravates Trump.
Yeah. Yeah,
and, you know,
exactly,
he has cachet in places where Trump was never able to get that cachet. And so he's actually a pretty good person to do that. Whether or not he has a serious chance to be the nominee, we just don't know whether this strategy of his is going to pay off yet. It's going to probably take till at least mid-March to get a sense on
that. So, Jeffrey, what do you think? I actually think that in a lot of ways – Bloomberg was really smart to run for president and not to use his money to focus on gun control and focus on climate. Because in a lot of ways, people are paying more attention to him. His ability to message is not only messaging on healthcare, not only messaging on climate, but taking the message directly to Trump. So whether he ultimately benefits, I think the Democratic Party is actually benefiting more from him spending his billions, you know, on this sort of ego trip running for president, because people are talking about him and focusing on him, and he's able to target a message in the midst of a presidential conversation. Jeff?
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. But, you know, the thing is that you said that the conversation has changed since Friday. And
yes,
I'm not quite clear where he fits in all this, because he's going to have to really assert himself on an area where he's not been very vocal all this time. He's very strong on a lot of issues, like you said, climate change, guns, other things. But to be clear now, with, you know, the main focus, at least the main question that many people are going to have is about security, and you know, what's going to set him apart from some of the other candidates. You know, Bernie Sanders could say, "I voted against the war in Iraq."
Yeah, exactly.
What can Michael Bloomberg say? You
yeah,
know?
Exactly.
I was the mayor after 9/11. I mean, you know,
but that's
down,
true.
But, you know,
that's
what
true.
I'm saying is it's not the same idea in terms of talking about national security.
Well, you know,
I'm not quite sure where it stands. Hold on, Giuliani.
Go on, Stephen.
Good arguments.
Well, no, I mean, yeah. I think this just this is exactly what Donald Trump wanted, Stephen. He wanted this chaos. You know, we were walking in thinking that we're going to be having a conversation and feeling sorry for all the senators going to be stuck in those impeachment hearings. And then we thought we were going to have this conversation talking about, you know, how good is the economy and what's the economy for, but for the very rich. Or we're going to talk about Medicare for All, the socialist plan that was going to take away your insurance. Think about what he's done. He's totally added to the sort of the chaos of this. And maybe in the end, he wants Joe Biden to be the nominee, because now he can use Hunter Biden and Ukraine against him. Now he can use his decision about the war in Iraq against Joe Biden. I mean, in a lot of ways, all Joe Biden's assets become his liabilities, and who gets to use them as liabilities but, you know, the liar in chief, Donald Trump.
Well, I think Trump is so mercurial and so sort of unaware of his own preferences that I think it's a fool errand to try to figure out what he wants and assume that sort of stable preferences over time. I do think all of this, and you point out sort of the chaos, this is something that biographers of Trump have been saying for decades, right, that this is the way in which he governs, that he is comfortable sitting amidst chaos. Most other people are not. So in his legal dealings, his real estate dealings, etc., he seeks to create conditions of maximum chaos, unsettle his perceived opponents, and put himself in a space where he feels comfortable. I think that the larger issue that connects this, that connects impeachment, that collects what's going on at the border, that connects sort of the whole host of issues about the dysfunction of the Trump administration, as the extent to which there is anything either internal within the executive branch or within Congress that will serve as an effective check on his worst impulses. And it's unclear that the answer is yes at this point.
Okay, so can I get breaking news? You ready, Dean? Here we go. Bolton willing to testify in Senate impeachment trial if subpoenaed. Former National Security Advisor John Bolton said Monday that he would testify at the Senate impeachment trial if subpoenaed. Now, this is very interesting, because the question was, what would he come? Now, I have to tell you something. Who's the happiest person about what just happened in Tehran? John Bolton. John Bolton has been beating this drum, sweetheart, forever. Mm. And who delivered but Donald Trump? He delivered the Bolton agenda. And no sooner, I mean, that was immediately what I thought about. The only person who's like high-fiving is John Bolton going, yes, look what I got out of this guy. And then I just read this, that he's agreed to testify in the impeachment. He's kind of an interesting wild card. Yeah. Everyone's assuming that, you know, he might actually hurt Donald Trump. Maybe this is payback.
Well, it raises the
oh my God,
interest and intrigue in having, certainly for those handful of Republicans who would be needed to set the rules to allow witnesses, this kind of raises the stakes a bit for everyone and may put additional pressure on Republicans
yep.
to allow some form of subpoenaed witnesses to testify.
Or but, to not allow.
Or to not allow. Yeah.
Either way, absolutely.
Exactly.
Either way, you're right. But I mean, a lot of it will sort of be driven by public opinion to some extent. But, yeah, I mean, my Twitter is ablaze with the Bolton says he'll testify.
Oh, my God. It's just
discussion.
It was just incredible. So we were talking about a little bit about what's happening now because of Iran. And it's interesting because AOC just came out with a statement. And I'm wondering, to some extent, if it also is related to Biden and his sort of foreign policy cred. And what AOC says, in any other country, Joe Biden and I would not be in the same party. Okay, Jeff Feingold, I'm going to start with you. And the reason I say this is, which party is Bernie in?
I think the Bernie party.
Thank you.
Well, AOC endorsed Bernie.
Party. Yeah. I'm just telling
you. I have to say something else about Joe Biden because the news came out, I think, today or yesterday, that there was an independence for Biden letter that went out in New Hampshire, and at the top of the list was Gordon Humphrey, which is a name from the past, but he's throwing his support behind Joe Biden. So
he's an independent?
Oh, yeah, he left the Republican Party.
Well,
he's
a big anti-Trump.
Yeah, he's a big anti-Trumper,
guy,
yes.
So. He's a huge anti-Trumper, and he's the one to call him psychotic, so... Oh.
Yep.
I think there's no going back after that.
Well, and now we have a confusing thing because did you hear what Lincoln? This is incredible.
Lincoln Chafee
has decided to run. Ready for this?
To the rescue.
Well, he's running to the rescue, but he's running as what? A libertarian. I mean, now I'm totally confused. What does libertarian mean, Steve? When you think about it, because if Chafee is a libertarian, I have no comprehension of what being a libertarian means. I mean, I'm looking at Bill Weld, who ran as a libertarian. Now I'm looking at Lincoln Chafee. They're taking over the Libertarian Party. The libertarians should be ticked. I mean, this is not what they planned.
I don't know what to tell you. I mean, those are not categories that we use in the United States, right, with any meaningful kind of way. We don't have, I mean, as Ocasio-Cortez identified, right, we live in a world in which we've got two political parties, and the Democratic Party in particular is really heterogeneous. There's all sorts of different people lumped together within that party. And in other countries, it's just there would be multiple parties there, so you could make maybe a little bit more sense of that.
Right.
So, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. A libertarian is whatever any particular individual who wants to use that word at the moment wants it to mean, in my experience.
Well, you know, so, Jeffrey, one of the things we were saying is Michael Bloomberg won't be on the stage for the debates. Okay?
Yes.
So how helpful are the debates? I'm just kidding.
It would be helpful for him at this point.
You do.
Right now, I think basically they can only hurt most candidates.
Right.
At this point, because they're going to some screw up, you know, calling Poland the free country like Judge Gerald Ford did or whatever, and
Soviet domination,
stuff like that. But in terms of for Bloomberg, but apparently he's not interested in being in a debate.
No.
I think that they would have helped him because they would have got him up on the stage and. He would have been on equal footing. I mean, he's not exactly the tallest man in the world. He'd have to have a box. That was mean.
Stop it. That's like,
sorry,
we make girl comments, too, I know. So,
yeah.
But he might be height challenged, but he clearly is not billions challenged.
No, not at all.
And that has enhanced his stature. So let's be honest here. So what we haven't talked about, which I think is also sort of this is a thing looming over everything. And I'm going to go to Australia, Dean. It is apocalyptic. It is beyond comprehension. And to a large extent, even though the biggest story from climate is Amazon, we don't have this sort of understanding or relationship to the Amazon. So we may have burned a lot of the Amazon, but a lot of people couldn't find it on a map. But Australia feels very much kind of like someplace that we have a relationship with and an orientation to, and they feel familiar. What is going on in Australia is just beyond understanding. And I'm wondering whether this climate change situation is going to sort of filter back into the conversation in part because of what we're seeing happening there, where they literally, they have no place to go. They're running into the water. And I mean, that's the ocean, because they have no place to go. I'm trying to figure out whether that ends up having part of the 2020 campaign actually say it is not about climate crisis, it is about now.
I'm not sure. I've said this before. I think it clearly is an issue that is very important in the Democratic primary. I think in the general election, there's always a possibility that it's going to get lost among a lot of the other issues, you know, impeachment and obviously this Iran and the Middle East. But it does have an apocalyptic feel. You mentioned the Amazon. You know, some of that has a more intentional feel of people on the ground making decisions to clear cut, et cetera. But
right.
but certainly you see the scenes from Australia and it just seems like stuff is kind of out of control. I mean, we've had some of that. We've had some of that in California. But this seems like this seems particularly destructive, and you know all the loss of wildlife, and you know koalas and kangaroos and all the you know exotic wildlife being killed by the thousands.
Well, there was a story,
Stephen,
that the Australia bushfires are creating their own weather systems.
Sure.
The blazes are generating thunderstorms and fire tornadoes, and I want to go back to a little bit about what happened with Iran. I think Donald Trump is trying to figure out how to push off anything that will actually harm him going into 2020. And as we're looking at the apocalyptic stories in Australia, that for a couple of days until Iran, that was a really big story on MSNBC and CNN and whatever. It's kind of disappeared again. You know, I just feel like he is such a mastermind at basically, you know, averting attention away from things that he finds are not useful to his 2020 campaign. And everything from Australia to what's going on with impeachment to everything else, he knows how to dominate really the national and international conversation, whether it's useful or not. Maybe it is useful for him, Stephen.
Yeah, well, you know, I have to, can I just say this? I didn't mean to interrupt, but one of the things that really kind of makes me have questions about this whole thing with this Iran escapade. You know, what happened last week also, like a day before the assassination, was the release of those documents, those emails from the organization.
Public Integrity?
From I can't remember the name right now. But anyway, they basically showed that the president knew that what he was doing was wrong, illegal.
Right.
He knew he was taking this action. It firms up the argument that he should be impeached because he was doing this brazenly. It was with people throughout his administration telling him not to do it. He did it anyway. You know, this is something you have to remember, that this is the kind of thing that he's trying to distract people from. It's not a coincidence to me. I just don't think it's a coincidence.
But you know what? Here's the problem, Stephen. Is he that sophisticated?
He's very reactive.
Well, Stephen,
I think reactive is a better way to put it. I mean, I think that, you know, in some ways this is sort of the central dilemma of our time, isn't it? Right? We've got a president who is manifestly incompetent and dangerous, I think, in a thousand different ways,
right.
And the evidence for that accumulates more and more over the course of every day. We've got
right.
political institutions that have demonstrated themselves insufficient to that challenge in an era of hyperpartisanship and not up to the task. And we've got a national media, and I didn't hear the opening of your show, but I heard the tail end of it, Arnie, talking about sort of the challenge of covering this. We've got sort of a national political media in particular that is just utterly unequipped to deal with this kind of challenge, right? Not just because they no longer dominate a space so that they can control a narrative and at least create the perception of elite consensus, but because there is no domination of elite messaging, right? It is spread through a million different sources, promulgated through Facebook and other networking apps. So under those circumstances, how do you then create reality-based knowledge among citizens that can then sort of put pressure on the elected officials of those institutions to maybe try to act. I don't have an answer to that question, but it frustrates the heck out of me in trying to think about what do we do in this moment? How do we address this?
Well, and there's another breaking story. I mean, this is I don't even want to open up like CNN anymore. It's like I'm terrified. Mm-hmm. So Dean, here's the live update. Pentagon chief of staff will resign as Iran tensions mount.
Okay.
I mean, what I think
well,
is
wouldn't
the,
you?
Well, no. I of course. But here's the thing, Dean. What's left? Who's making anything? I mean, the level of vulnerability at every single level that anyone with any kind of expertise, with any kind of institutional knowledge, with any kind of any, everyone is abandoning ship. And they, frankly, they have to because
but this has been going on for 3 years. Trump is not a fan of expertise unless it reinforces his gut level intuitions on a particular
and likes to mix things issue. Up in order to mix things up.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
And he's moving towards essentially running a family business out of the White House. We've talked about this many times. There's no use for the kind of the expert bureaucratic decision-making apparatus that basically has been built up since World War II. There's no use for it.
So what I'm trying to figure out, though, Jeffrey, is that historically, you know that the Defense Department and the Pentagon have been very sort of supportive of this guy. We're beginning to see that change. If you see more and more of these leaders basically saying, I will not perform an illegal act, I will leave, I will quit. If this begins to happen, what happens to the Pentagon and to the military? How do they respond? They are not going to embrace an illegal act. He's being told that that's really what they want to do. You know, and I'm just trying to figure out, when does that trigger a lot of the Trump base to realize that these are their people? I mean, we're talking about a lot of those states where they have a lot of military activity in places like South Carolina, in places like that. When does that trickle down and that begins to say, you are now putting my family at risk because of your behavior, and even the generals are now walking away and abandoning you? This is a life and death situation for these people. This is not theoretical. This is about their lives.
Yeah, but if you go on 3 years of Trump, I would have said that about many other things that were going on. And I just don't have any belief that the base is anywhere near showing any cracks at this point. He's done so many things anti-military over the 3 years, but he seems to be invulnerable to that when it comes to the base.
And
I don't know. I don't know when that could happen. It's possible that it could happen, but I've given up on predicting when something could happen to the Trump
base.
I look at that 40% approval rating, 43, whatever it is now. It's steady. It is steady as a rock. It just does not really waver too much, despite all of the scandals, all of the accusations. All of the proof and evidence has been given about his inabilities, the illegalities, the self-aggrandizement, all that stuff. It's just not doesn't work.
But that 40% floor is in a world without recession. I think that is the single thing that could most, and you made reference to it earlier, Jeff, with oil prices.
Yeah.
I think that is the thing. We're not going to wipe out that base, but I bet it goes from 40 to closer to 30.
Yeah, with the economy, but not with an exodus.
Not
from
with anything
Pentagon.
Else. I agree. Not with anything else. Yep.
So I guess here's my question: if that is such a solid base, Dean Spiliotis, then what is the appeal of Biden saying I can reach across the aisle, I can get those Trump voters to vote for me? Really? Based on what? I mean, I'm hearing about the fact he can do anything.
Yeah,
he can do anything, Dean, and they won't leave him. Mm-hmm. So as Biden is saying, I have the appeal. I'm going, really, where do you find that reaction?
Yeah, but I wouldn't confuse the or conf, not confuse
conflate.
But conflate yeah absolutely conflate the Trump base with everyone who either voted for Trump last time or decided not to vote or
decided
voted third
not
party.
To vote. Okay,
so they've never argued. I mean I think Jeff is right. That base is pretty much impenetrable. They believe in him. They see him almost as kind of a transcendent. Almost a religious figure, really, if you listen to some of the rhetoric.
A cult,
A cult or religious or whatever descriptor you want to use. But the issue is, I think Biden's argument is like this letter from local independents that there are people either who didn't vote in the Midwest, who might vote, or, you know, for example, we all point to Republican women who voted Democratic in the 2018 midterm. Mm-hmm. Those sorts of persuadable folks that he can in some way bring them out. Now, the question is, if he does that, you know, if Bernie's not the nominee, what are his supporters going to do?
Right.
Are they going to vote third party? Are they going to stay home? So, I mean, you can game this out a number of ways. But that, so, the base is, you know, he's going to have that 40, so, low 40s.
Well, couldn't you say the same thing, though, Dean, about if Biden's not the nominee, who are his supporters going to go to?
Yeah.
Are his supporters actually going to vote for Trump?
Well, I actually saw, I actually read a few people on Twitter saying there should be a Sanders and Biden ticket to maybe, but that may
that was
make,
me. That was me.
That
That's me.
Yeah. I'm just make everybody unhappy.
No, no, no. Exactly. No, no. No, Stephen. I actually said.
Oh, so
should,
it was you. I know
it was me. It was
said,
no,
okay.
No. I actually said that there should be either a Biden Sanders or a Sanders Biden ticket, and in part because it. How do I say this? But it is it. My concern is, what do you bring out and what do you lose? You know, I mean, the fact that, you know, that Biden basically, there is no enthusiasm for him anywhere. Even in his supporters, they're not enthused about Biden. I mean, yes. They're willing to embrace him. They can talk themselves into it. They can, but the level of enthusiasm just basically disappears. And my question then becomes, is what a Bernie or a Warren or maybe even to some extent a Mayor Pete are able to do, is that they're able to sort of generate, you know, new voters to come into the system. It's not just the apathetic ones that didn't vote in 2016. It's about the new invitation in.
Sure.
And isn't that new invitation, Stephen, really what's going to be critical to a win? I don't care about the 14 that didn't vote in 2016. I care about the thousands that may actually exercise the franchise in 2020.
Turnout is going to be about mobilization.
Totally.
Any one of those candidates with enough people working the ground systematically can get people out. I think that odds are in favor of a high turnout election regardless.
So, Jeffrey, could a Sanders-Biden, Biden-Sanders ticket actually make sense?
I guess. I mean,
I think
it
it's
raises
incredible.
Questions about, you know,
I know.
Age and
I love it. Oh my God, they're 140
but,
years
I mean,
old
but,
between the two of them.
Could you imagine Donald Trump saying, "I'm younger than those guys"?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Just, I could, you know,
do the addition.
You know, he'll get that doctor out. You know, who looks like
I know,
the
but,
president in the history of the Republic.
But here's the good news:
exactly.
Neither of them are obese, so at least we've got something going for them. All right, I need to let you go. Thank you so much, Stephen Pimper. Thank you, Jeff Feingold. Thank you, Dean Spiliotis. And how do we end this show, Monsieur?
Still crazy after all these years, sung by Ray Charles, and you were talking about how
there
Trump is
absolutely crazy. Here we go.
Still crazy.
Yeah. I met my old lover on the street last night. She seemed so glad to see me, I just smiled. And we talked about some old times, and we drank ourselves some beers. Still crazy after all the years. I'm still crazy after all the years. I'm not the kind of man who tends to socialize. I seem to lean on old familiar ways. And I ain't no fool for love songs that whisper in my ear. Still crazy after all the years. Said I know I am. Oh, just crazy after all these.